One of the biggest questions we get asked at Leading Saints is, how do I lead when I'm not called to be a leader? We all want to influence our local communities, wards, and stakes for the better, but how can it be done without stepping on the toes of those who have been called to lead? Well, we answered this question in a free PDF called How to Lead When You're Not the Leader, 6 Steps to Be Influential Without a Title. If you'd like a free copy of this article, it is only available by texting the word LEAD to 474747. Again, text the word LEAD to 474747 to get a copy of How to Lead When You're Not the Leader.
Hi, my name is Kevin Lash. I'm a bishop in the Salt Lake City area. I've listened to the Leading Saints podcast for several years, as well as reading the newsletter, participating in the virtual summits, and even bunking with Kurt at Warrior Heart Boot Camp. Having a church calling, especially one with a lot of responsibility, can be terrifying. Our callings put us into spaces we have never been in before, and we don't want to harm anyone by our own lack of knowledge as we carry out our stewardship. I've felt this many times as a bishop. The ways I've learned how to address these situations, magnify my calling, and expand my knowledge include: first, rely on the Spirit. Second, read the handbook. Third, ask people that I trust for their perspective, especially my counselors and my wife. Fourth, always keep learning new skills and learning from the experience and wisdom of others. This is where Leading Saints has been irreplaceable. I have used literally dozens and dozens of ideas, counseling techniques, leadership strategies, life hacks, and inspiration that I've gained through being a core subscriber and a voracious consumer of the content on Leading Saints. I will close with something that I wrote in an email to Kurt earlier today. Thanks for the amazing work you do, Kurt. I could never have done what I have as bishop without the guidance, content, inspiration, and ideas you have given me through Leading Saints. You have blessed many lives in my ward, and you have blessed me. Be a leader and a learner and a follower, not a calling.
Happy August to all of you out there. This is the Leading Saints podcast. I'm your host, Kurt Frankum. I welcome you back. Now, if you're new to Leading Saints, this is a cute little podcast that we put together. It's in conjunction with a greater nonprofit organization called, well, Leading Saints. And our goal and mission is to help Latter-day Saints be better prepared to lead in all aspects of life: home, church, work, local community boards, wherever it is. We want to help you be a better leader. Now, in this podcast, it's awesome because I got to sit down in the Lieutenant Governor's office of Utah with the Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. And we talk all things leadership in the context of him being the bishop and mayor at the same time of Fairview, Utah, a few years ago. And he currently serves as primary music leader. So yes, I threw the hard-hitting questions at the Lieutenant Governor all about all things primary program, leading the children's music in primary, and it's a fascinating discussion. And currently, Spencer Cox is running for governor. And obviously, Leading Saints is an apolitical organization, so this interview isn't meant to endorse or encourage anybody to vote a certain way. We're just always looking for interesting people to interview about leadership, especially members of the church. And Spencer Cox being one of those in a unique career in politics and also with some unique background in leadership, we thought it would be awesome to interview him. So it's a good one. Here is my interview with the Lieutenant Governor of Utah, Spencer Cox. Today, I find myself in the State Capitol building in the office of the Lieutenant Governor with the actual Lieutenant Governor, Spencer Cox. How are you?
I'm well, Kurt. It's great to be with you. I'm a big fan. I'm glad we got a chance to do this.
About that. You and my mom, I guess, and Kirsten, your chief of staff, who also listens, who's in the room with us. So feel free to chime in. You can just yell over to the mics here.
But she was really just excited to meet you. I told her she couldn't come, and she came anyway.
Well, here I am. We'll get pictures later for Twitter and so forth. But so you're also a candidate to be governor of Utah. That's pretty cool.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm still not sure why, but I am. Yeah.
Well, I'm a fan of your podcast, which is Cox and Friends, which is a genius title. And it's fun to hear sort of that process you went through to decide become a candidate, because it's sort of sometimes it's assumed when the big guy leaves, the second in command maybe is often discussed, and you are second in command, right?
Well, I am, and I get that all the time. It was just kind of a foregone conclusion that I would run, and I say we a lot because it's a family event, and it could not have been further from a foregone conclusion. That's what people don't understand, is that we never really wanted this. This is never, it's not like we grew up, I grew up thinking, yeah, someday I want to be governor. You know, that's that's not it at all. All of this happened kind of by accident, I feel. And don't get me wrong, we're very grateful for the opportunities that we have had to serve. But when the governor asked me to be the lieutenant governor, it was a shock to us. I was a freshman in the House and I was part-time. It was kind of a hobby, a way to give back and something I enjoyed. But when the governor asked us to consider running, it was a really hard decision. We did all the things that you do when you're making big life decisions. Mm-hmm. And that was important to us. We believe that, you know, that we have a Father in heaven who cares deeply about all of us, all of his children, and wants what's best for us and has a path and helps us make those decisions, whether it's, you know, whether to have another child, whether to, whether to run for office, what job to take, or, you know, mm-hmm. all of those, what school to go to. I believe he cares about that stuff. Now, I always have to put this caveat on there. Just because we felt inspired to run for office doesn't mean that we're supposed to win.
Right.
I just, anytime a candidate for office says, yes, you know, God wants me to be the next mayor or something, I'm like, do not vote for that person, right. Run away. Right. That's not how it works. But there is so much to be learned from the process and from running and having the faith to do what you're supposed to do. And so here we are, for better or worse. It was a crazy decision. It's turned our lives upside down, but we're learning a lot and we're meeting some amazing people and it's worth it.
Yeah. And you have an RV that you're going around to the major cities in Utah, right?
Yeah. So when when you're going through things you don't think about, like you have to come up with a logo, right? To run. And I've been in private business. I ran a telecommunications company for 10 years. So I'm very familiar with marketing. But this was really hard. Like, you know, what colors, what font, what does it look like? And we wanted something that was true to us. And we live in Sampy County on a farm in Fairview. My great, great, great grandfather settled. And I just looked outside and there was our John Deere tractor. And I'm like, that's it. Green and yellow. Those are our colors. It's going to stand out. It's going to be different. We did some other things that were important to that. And we had this crazy idea to visit all 248 cities in Utah because like candidates for governor never came to Fairview, mm-hmm. right? We just got overlooked. And I thought, that's not cool. I mean, that's, you know, we want to go where the people are. And no one had ever done that as a declared candidate for governor. So we thought, well, how are we going to do that? And my dad has an RV, you know, it's like 6 or 7 years old. And he told us we could borrow it whenever we needed it. And we've used it a couple times. And so I went to my dad and I said, can we borrow the RV? He's like, yeah, what are you going to do with it? I said, just don't ask any questions.
We are going to paint it green.
Yeah, right? we wrapped it, entire wrap, green and yellow with my giant head on the side of it. But the problem is like my other siblings get to use it as well. And so like my brother came, he's like, well, we've got this Lake Powell trip plan. And I'm like, are you okay if my head's on the side of the RV? And he's like, sure. So 2 weeks ago, he took it to Lake Powell, got a lot of looks, a lot of people stopping to talk to him about policy issues. He's like, no, that's not me. That's the other guy. We'll get you nice. In touch with him. But yeah, we're in the RV and traveling cool. the state.
That's cool. Now, growing up in a small town, I'm curious about where the spark of politics came for you. Where did it begin where you thought, maybe this will be a career path for me?
Well, the thing about growing up in a small town is it's kind of always around you. And I will say my dad was the mayor when I was 8 years old,
oh, okay.
but so was everyone else. Like,
yeah, you take around. A turn. Like being bishop, everybody
yeah,
gets a turn.
That's right. No, it really is. Everybody's been on the city council. You do that. So I was always interested in it because of that. And I studied political science in school at Utah State University, not because I was that interested in politics. I knew I wanted to go to law school. That's the thing I knew is that I wanted to be an attorney. And I've since repented of that.
Good.
I'm a recovering attorney, so we're
he's
so
gone politician. I don't know if that's
so
recovering.
Over. No, I've chosen the only thing worse apparently. But so that wasn't it. I was always interested, and we were taught from a very early age you have to give back. That was really important to us, to our community. And so like my cousins are all volunteer firefighters and EMTs, and you know they do that stuff. And I don't like blood or fire. I'm not very good at either of those. And having gone to law school, when we moved back to Fairview, a friend of mine came to me, and I've shared this story before, but there was a vacancy on the city council. And he said, we talked about it. We want to appoint you. It wasn't an election. They were just appointing someone. And I was flattered, you know, and I said, well, yeah, why do you think I'd be good? And he said, well, it's your turn because you just moved back. We need somebody.
And you have a law degree. That's right.
So that was the second part. He said, we have a lot of legal problems in Fairview and we can't afford an attorney. And so, so I literally got involved in politics to do basically free legal work for Fairview. They had a lawsuit that was pending. And so I got involved and helped with that. And I got to be the mayor and I found it really rewarding in that it was a way I could give back. It was a way I felt like I could make a difference. And again, having a law degree and coming back to a small town where I was, you know, I'm trying to think if there was anybody else in Fairview city limits with a law degree. I think I was probably the only one. And so I had a skill set that was very helpful there. And then I got to be a county commissioner down in Sanpete County, worked on some big issues there during the Great Recession. And then I decided to run for the House of Representatives because it was kind of, at that point I thought I enjoy this. But again, it was part time. I was running the telecommunications company, making good money, and I was coaching my kids in basketball and baseball and football, and I had a 1 mile commute, and I had the perfect life. I was farming on the weekends, and it was good. And then 9 months in the House, when the governor asked me to be lieutenant governor, when Greg Bell resigned, and so that spark though came from the way I was raised, who raised me, and just this desire to try to want to make the world a better place. And that was one avenue to do it. Although a lot of people would argue, and rightfully so, that politics has made the world a worse place lately. And they're not wrong.
Yeah. So I'm curious, most people may not know that you also served as a bishop at the time, same time that you were mayor of your town. So which came first, the mayor or the being called as bishop?
I think, oh gosh, that's a really good question. They were very close in time, very, very close. I think I got elected mayor and then got called to be the bishop. I should know this. Sorry, really
but
close.
It was close,
time.
Though. Yeah. So what do you remember from that experience of being called as bishop? What was the, I mean, did you expect that to come? I mean, nobody ever really does, but was the bishop being released or
yeah, we knew it was close to time for the bishop to be released. And so, you know, there's always a speculation and you have a few people kind of campaigning.
Especially in small towns.
Yeah, right? Seeing how many hands they can shake. I was not that guy at all. And no, I honestly had not thought of it all because we'd only been back in Fairview a couple of years. We had just moved back or maybe a year. I was a young men's president. I'd only been in that for about a year and I was really enjoying it. And I was young. I was 29 and I remember going home one day and just having, and you've heard this before, I'm not the first. I just had this terrible feeling. It wasn't supposed to be like this really inspirational feeling. It was more of a pit in my stomach and I couldn't figure it out. And it just hit me. I'm like, oh no. And I actually said, I actually went and checked the voicemail on our home phone because I just knew there, and sure enough, I had a call from the state clerk to go meet with the state president. Uh-huh. And I just told my wife, I said, I hope this isn't what I think it is, but this is what I think it is.
Yeah.
And we went down and had the conversation. And I just remember my wife just crying. She's like, we had three little boys and we, you know, the politics, I was either the mayor or I was running for mayor. Or on the city council. I think I was the mayor. And we just had, you know, a lot on our plate. And for a young couple, we didn't think there were so many other people that were much more prepared and seasoned for that. We were sure somebody had made a huge mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious, like what the demographic was like. I mean, farm town, lots of humble farmers that come to church and appreciate church. So what did you find was the most challenging? Obviously, especially as a 29-year-old bishop, was there anything that stood out?
Yeah. I mean, the most challenging part for me had to do with the welfare issues, for sure, combined with, you know, the marriage counseling piece of that, where I've got people who, you know, have been married 30 years and are struggling with their marriage. And, you know, we're just these kids trying to figure our way through it all. Those were the hard parts. I will tell you that I learned very quickly. And a couple of years, well, not actually, I didn't learn quickly enough, but there was a group of people, you know, maybe 5% of the ward that took up 90% of my time. And that was true for the bishop before me and the bishop after me. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but it's, you know, clearly those that struggled the most and needed a lot of attention. And that's where I struggled the most, was trying to help them, because my life, and one of the reasons I was interested in politics is I like to solve problems and I like to fix things. And sometimes I couldn't fix those things. And they, you know, these were generational issues often. And that was really disheartening for me. But I had a revelatory experience about maybe a year and a half into it when I realized that I wasn't going to fix those problems and that where I could make the biggest impact. And this may sound obvious to most people, but it came like a lightning bolt from heaven, was focusing on the youth and the youth of the ward. The youth of those families too, a way to break intergenerational poverty, intergenerational social and mental and spiritual problems was really by focusing on the youth. And it was, for me, it was like a burden lifted when I thought, you know what, my Relief Society president, my Elders Quorum president, my High Priest group leader, my counselors, have fun with all these problems, because I'm there are some you can't help me with, but you're taking most of them, and I'm going to spend every minute I have with our young people. And it was just awesome. We had so much fun, and I think made a real difference after that.
So, and obviously, you know, you mentioned just generally delegating some of those other requests to the auxiliary leaders. Was there, I mean, a lot of times it's just not that easy, because people, no, I want to talk with the bishop, and this is I need to talk with the bishop. So was there anything about that process that made that easier to delegate, or how did you go about empowering those auxiliary leaders to feel like they could step up and handle some of those problems?
No, it wasn't easy. And, you know, I'm not sure we ever got it exactly right, but I also knew that, you know, I wasn't going to solve those problems, a lot of them. And so I just had great people who were willing to step up and take more of a burden. And quite frankly, I started being a lot more blunt with some of the people I was working with. And I think it's something we fear to do as leaders sometimes.
Especially church leaders.
Especially church leaders.
We want to be the nice guy.
Yeah, you know? But you know, even the Savior went into the temple once and got upset with people. And that's, again, you treat them with love and you treat them as the Savior would. But sometimes that meant saying no. You know, no, I've met with you 5 times and last you haven't done anything I've asked. So until you're ready to really start making some progress, then, you know, no, we're not going to meet tonight. I remember one time I did kind of lose it. It was 11 o'clock at night. It was with a couple I have no idea how many times I'd met with them. It was my birthday and they, you know, they were fighting like, you know, like 4 and 5 year olds, you know, would fight, taking toys from each other. Mm-hmm. And I just finally looked at them and said, you know what? I'm done with this. You guys, this, you know, and I kind of let loose on them and I think they were stunned. And they, you know, I didn't run them away from the church or anything. And I apologized to them afterwards. But they saw the folly of what they were doing too. And so sometimes there does need to be a little tough love or just saying, hey, no, you're not going to meet with me anymore. Here, the Relief Society president is going to try to help you and we'll talk again in a month. You know, we'll figure those things out. So it's different in every situation and you have to follow the Spirit in making those decisions, obviously. But sometimes I think we feel like we're indispensable when we're really not. Sometimes we don't delegate because we think we're too important or we're too good at what we do. And that's unfair to the people underneath us who need those opportunities to grow and progress as well.
Yeah. Reminds me of a quote. I think it's Elder Condi that said, I forget his first name, it was a while ago, but he says that cemeteries are full of leaders who think they're indispensable.
it's a great quote.
You know, it's just it's so true. Like if we really aren't the only person that can do it. And it sounds like in this scenario, like it, you know, you use the word blunt, like just because you're blunt at times doesn't mean that love isn't there. I mean, you can always follow up with love, apologize if maybe you came across too blunt.
Show an increase of love afterwards, right? Yeah. It is part of the model.
Right. Sure. And it also sounds like just like empowering those, like going to your auxiliary leaders and bluntly empowering them, saying, no, you are going to take some of this load and I need you to, because my focus is going to be with the youth, right? And that's empowering.
And it is. And then there's buy-in from them as well. They feel like they're an indispensable part of the team.
Yeah.
And they feel like they have a role to do and they understand why I'm doing it. It's not just because I'm lazy or, you know, or just tired or whatever. It's because I had felt a mandate to really focus on our young people. And it was great. We would do these, we would do a monthly breakfast, at like, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning with the priests and the laurels, and they would come and they would, we would have them write down questions that they'd always wanted to ask but didn't dare, and they were anonymous. And so we would take those questions and we would just start talking about them. And some of the most incredible, engaging, and spiritual experiences I've ever had were with those young people. And I would have missed that opportunity if I hadn't listened and followed through.
Yeah, that's awesome. Any other principles, if you were to go back to day one with Bishop Spencer Cox there and say, hey, here's a principle you really need to understand. I mean, you talk about the delegating and focusing on the youth. Any other that come to mind?
Wow, that's an interesting one that I guess for me, and part of this had to do with age. Well, actually, I'll tell you a story because this was a big change for me too. And I wish I'd known this when I got it, but it took me a little while. I had been in the calling maybe for a month or two, and I had spent, it was a Sunday. I had gotten up early. You know, we had our meetings, had gone through the day, and then we had some stake meetings, some Bishop Burke training meetings, and then the Bishop's Council with the stake presidency. And I pull into my garage it had to be like 11 o'clock at night, you know, and I had been up since about 5 o'clock that morning, and I was done. I was just exhausted. And during the day, I'd been keeping notes about things that I had to do, right? And I pulled out this sheet of paper, and it had, I want to say there was at least 26 or 27 things that I had to do, that I had to get done from this training and everything I needed to do. And I just looked at it, and I kind of lost it. I'm out in the garage all by myself, you know, and tears are kind of falling. And I don't often get, in fact, I almost never get the type of revelation where you maybe even hear a voice. And right. I got the most distinct impression to put that paper away and never look at it again. And just, it's going to be okay. Do the best you can. I had one bishop who shared with me, he said, there's no problem too great that it can't wait until next Sunday. Now, that's probably a terrible way to live your life. And there's, you know, procrastination. I'm not here advocating for that. But I said, you know, I was told very distinctly to put that away and never look at it again, and went back. I found that paper when I was cleaning out my desk on the last day of being bishop. And I went back and looked over it. And there were probably 10 or 15 things on there that never happened or never got done, were never really that important. And I realized that while it's important to be organized and stay on top of things, of course, but there is a need for heart in this and spirit and direction and not running faster than we're capable of doing. And I was trying to be everything to everyone and worried about what people would think or who I would let down and be disappointed. And that's a lesson I wished I would have known on day one, and I'm glad I learned over time, but it's going to be okay. You know, he'll pick up the pieces, he'll pick up the rest, and we'll figure it out. We're very imperfect people in this church.
Now, I love that principle because especially, you know, you meet with a stake president or a stake president goes to a coordinating council and you walk out with that list like, okay, here's, you know, 20 things I need to make sure get done. And you know, of course we want to get it done, but we can be so distracted by those things and lose focus. Like you said, I want to focus on the youth, and that list can quickly take you off. And suddenly it's Sunday again, and you haven't even thought about the youth, right? So I think that's a powerful principle.
No, that's it. It's just that. Again, there are important things, but the discernment into what you should be focusing on and where your emphasis should be and your focus. And again, that's going to be different for every ward. That's why when you do go to these trainings as leaders, I think it is important to point out. And one of the greatest lessons I ever learned was from Elder Ballard when he was, it was Elder Scott. Elder Scott came to the MTC when I was there. And, you know, when you get a member of the 12 there, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, okay, I have to capture this moment and I have to write down everything he says because this is going to help me as a missionary. And I know he's given a talk on this before, but in that moment, we're furiously writing and he just stops like mid-sentence. And he looks at us and we're all feverishly waiting for what he's going to say next. And he says, all right, guys, put your pens away, stop writing what I'm saying and start listening for what you're supposed to learn. And he said, that may be very different. I may be talking about one thing and your mind and the spirit will tell you to focus on something else. That's the thing you should be writing, not my words. That's not what matters. And I think that was an important principle because we get in these trainings and it's just like a checklist and gospel by checklist is just a terrible way to do the gospel. Yeah. We end up getting overwhelmed. That's not how the Spirit works. He's going to tell you the two or three things, or maybe one thing, that you really need to focus on. And it may not even be one of the things that's being taught in that lesson or in that training, but being aware enough and confident enough to follow those promptings, that will make us successful in anything we do.
I love that. Awesome. Any other principle or concept from your time as bishop that come to mind that would be helpful to touch on? If not,
I think those are it. I mean, you know, it was weird being the mayor and the bishop at the same time, yeah. Especially in a small town.
Yeah.
That was hard. I'd have to have interesting conversations with people. And of course, not only that, but we were the biggest employer in town too, with the telecommunications wow. business where we work. So mm-hmm. I had employees who were my employees, and I was their bishop and I was their mayor, and all of those things intertwined in so many
ways. Emperor of the universe.
Well, it's it's not, if for those in small towns, the people are laughing right now because they've all been there. Yeah. And by the way, the bishop before me was also the mayor.
Oh, really?
So yeah. So true story.
Part of the calling almost.
It is. But I remember very distinctly that we were also the municipal power system. We had our own power system. And so I would have to turn off somebody's power and their water because they didn't pay. And then I would go write out a check from the church to turn their power and water back on. And these were some of the, just the crazy experiences that conundrums that I found myself in. But people are great and people are very understanding. And I made a deal with them that I would separate those two things. And if they had a problem with the city, to come and talk to me about that. And that would not impact them at church in any way.
Yeah, yeah.
And vice versa. So people got it. And it was a great time in our life.
Nice. Really. So how long did you serve as bishop?
So I was bishop for almost 5 years,
okay.
Just short of 5 years. I got elected to the county commission. And then I remember the state president coming to me and saying, hey, look, that's a lot on your plate. And so I think I was 4 months shy of 5 years, right around there. And it was, again, an awesome opportunity, an awesome experience. I remember my wife, as we were there getting released, just tears streaming down her face, and the state president saying something like, I know this is such a hard day for you to get released. And she says, no, I'm crying because I'm so happy. Like, yeah. This is the best day of our lives. I get my husband back. And uh-huh. although that was short-lived, I remember the first Sunday in church sitting with my wife. We had a little girl during that time as well. So now I had four kids, and I don't know what I was doing, but I was not being helpful. I know. And making
been
it
there,
worse.
Been there. Yeah.
And my wife just turned to me. She said, Hey, we have a system here. If you're not going to be helpful, you've got to go sit somewhere else. So don't mess with the system. So, but it was something we look back on fondly and learned a great deal.
Nice. So what's your church experience now as a lieutenant governor? Obviously, they're not going to call the lieutenant governor as the state president or in the state presidency or anything like that, right?
So correct.
What's that dynamic like?
Yeah. So I taught gospel doctrine for almost 6 years. I started before I was lieutenant governor and did it mm-hmm. for 5 years during the lieutenant governor. And now I am the primary chorister,
which
is maybe the best job in the church. It's pretty close anyway.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it. I'm really grateful for the Facebook group. We're not the primary choristers anymore, whatever we call us, the music leaders.
Yeah.
There's a Facebook group with 5,000, almost all women. And I'm a member of that group.
And the lieutenant governor pipes up.
Well, yeah, they just share their ideas with me, because my schedule's so crazy, I don't have time to prepare like I should. And thankfully, to these wonderful women who do a lot of work and then share it with other people, I get to just copy what they're doing early Sunday morning and prepare. Uh-huh. And it's pretty great.
Oh, cool. So have you done a primary program yet?
No, my first primary program is coming up in October.
Nice. Yeah, so what are you learning from that process?
Well, what's interesting is with the changes that have happened in the church curriculum and the church schedule with Come Follow Me, this calling is actually really important to these kids. I mean, it's always important. I don't mean that, but we don't have sharing time anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so the presidency doesn't do much in as far as teaching goes.
Right.
So I get 25 minutes with these kids, and then they get 20 minutes in class every Sunday, and that's it. And so it's a really cool opportunity to teach the doctrine. And I love music. I'm just passionate about music. It's how I learn best. It's where I've always felt the Spirit the most. I was in music groups in high school And in college, I was in the LD Singers at Snow College, and we would travel around and do concerts at for young men and young women and groups all over the state. And so now I get to share that love of music and these gospel principles with these kids who are so eager and so excited. And they make it fun, and it's hard, and it's awesome. And I love everything about it.
So just give me, and I'm bringing the hard hitting questions to Lieutenant Governor office here. But so what's like a best practice you've learned that a primary music leader would benefit from, whether it's related to the primary program or just the week to week assignment?
Yeah. So I'm still learning. I mean, I've only been doing it now for, I think, 4 months, maybe 5 months. So I'm really new into it. So I'm actually learning from a lot of people, but in this forum, I hear, you know, a lot of people post, hey, I'm new at this. I'm not very good at it. What do you recommend? And you can go a little bit overboard. You know, you could spend all of your time preparing the right charts and the right activities. And a lot of people do, and that's great. That's fine. But for me, the thing I'm learning, and this last week I really focused on this, was again the doctrinal piece. It's fun, and we do have fun, but I want to try to have a moment where the Spirit, where they feel the Spirit there. And you know, you can do head, shoulders, knees, and toes, and that's fun, and it gets the wiggles out, and it gets them excited. But if you get a chance to bear your testimony to those kids, I mean, those are the things I remember growing up. I don't remember everything that was said. I remember what I felt at times and how that impacted me. And so I'm trying harder. I wasn't doing this at first, but the last few weeks I've been trying harder to have a moment during this 25 minutes where we inject the Spirit and we talk about something impactful, and I get to bear testimony to that.
I think that's important, because it's easy to probably default just to, you know, this is Barney and Friends hour. Like, I'm going to be a clown up here for 20 minutes, but to really just step back and say, how can I interject gospel principles? Because that's where, I mean, I can still remember songs, moments when I was in primary and that music leader that was facilitating that.
And don't get me wrong, there's room for the Barney moments.
Right.
You need those, and especially to keep them engaged and to make it fun for them. And you have to do that. But yeah, you're right. Again, this is a building block, foundational. Again, we focus a lot on young men and young women, but primary is really where it starts for these kids, that initial seed of their testimonies. And I remember the talk that Elder Packer gave when we were kids about when bad thoughts come in, you think of a song or sing a hymn or whatever. And that's always been kind of my life strategy. And I'm hoping to provide that for these kids.
Awesome. That's great. Fun conversation. So I want to shift a little bit to, there's two books that you've influenced me to read. One is A Team of Rivals. You mentioned one of your favorites, and I loved it. I mean, it took a while to get through that.
Big book, but incredible. It's about Abraham Lincoln and his leadership style.
Yeah,
and
it's remarkable.
Bringing people in that ran against him for president and kind of hated him, and finding a way to make all of that work, and so well written, and just really, really incredible stuff.
And the movie Lincoln is based off of really the end of that book. I mean, it doesn't cover quite as much as the entire book. And then the second book you influenced me is Them by the senator from Nebraska. Ben Sass. And this was just an impactful book for me, because I spent a lot of time, especially in the context of leading saints, where I'm always analyzing the model of a quorum or a relief society. Like, what benefit is that really doing? And a lot of times it's just sort of, we go through the motions. We go to quorum meeting every week. We go to relief society. But how can we really leverage this to be an impact? And the book Them, which the subtitle is Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal by Senator Ben Sass. So this is intriguing. So what about this book maybe impacted you the most? Like, what are the principles that now you sort of take into the meetings of Lieutenant Governor and maybe someday as the governor? What principles really stood out to you?
Well, so I it's important. And I've said this before, that I've often thought, you know, if I wrote a book, what would it be? And I'd kind of formulated what that idea would be. And then I read Ben Sass's book, and he wrote the best version of the book I would have written. So this just, it spoke to every experience I've had throughout my life and enlightened me to some I had experienced but hadn't really understood. So I think, just as a basis, the whole premise of this book, he's trying to figure out why politics is so messy right now, so divided. And we can show this. I mean, of course, we had the Civil War. The 60s were a pretty dark time, into the 70s with the Vietnam War and some things that were going on. But right now, we are as polarized as we've been. And political science can look at this historically. So he's trying to figure out why. And there's some great stuff by Putnam, the researcher from Harvard. He wrote a book, Bowling Alone, and some others that talk about how our society is changing. And he hypothesizes that we are, the start of it, actually, and he uses some research from BYU, that we are lonelier than we've ever been before. So we have fewer close friends, people that we can share our hopes and dreams with. We know fewer of our neighbors than ever before. And he starts looking at the decay of these institutions that have been so critical over the history of our country. Some of those institutions are kind of the volunteer-based, nonprofit type institutions. That Rotary Club is a good example of that. Elks Lodge, these groups that would bring people together in their communities to build up their communities, and how they're failing. Now, if you go to a Rotary Club meeting, you know, most of the people there are over the age of 70. It's, you know, you don't see a lot of young people there anymore. He talks about the rise of social media and how it's, you know, it's bringing us together, but in all the wrong ways. Like, we're finding tribes, and talks about tribalism, but because we don't have any friends, at least we can hate the same people together online. And that's,
is awful.
It's awful, but it resonates. It's true. And cable media and the rise of that. But he talks about churches as well, and how church attendance is down, and the role historically that churches played in the formation of our country. Government wasn't designed to solve all of our problems, because we had these other institutions that would do that. And churches were one of those. And so when you ask the question, kind of what resonated with me, Utah's an interesting place. And we receive a lot of accolades for being the best managed state, the best state for business. Our economy's doing remarkably well. But when you start to break it down about what makes us different, there are a couple of statistics that stand out. One, we volunteer more per capita than anywhere else. Our charitable giving is higher than anywhere else. We do have still these strong institutions, the church being one of them, and other churches as well. Don't get me wrong. There are very strong faith-based communities across the state that are lifting people up, and how important it is to preserve that. And so what I started thinking of, by the way, he has another book called The Vanishing American Adult that came out before this one. And it was about how our young people are in a perpetual state of adolescence. They're never growing up, because we've lost a lot of the rites of passage historically. We worked on farms, and we were surrounded by grandparents, and we worked together in communities, and we had these rites of passage that meant a way to adulthood. Now, so bringing this back, I promise I'm coming around, but what stood out to me in both of those books are how many of those boxes get checked by the form, take the spiritual outside of it, but just the formal organization of what we do in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is an antidote to the problems that he's talking about. So with the idea of perpetual adolescence, getting baptized at age 8, for young men, the priesthood at age 12, young women going into the young women's program, we still do have these rites of passage where there's an expectation that comes with those, and that matters. And there's more responsibility that comes with those. Those matter. And the missionary program is the coup de grace there. I mean, that's where you really grow up.
I grew up.
Yeah, so. Me too. My son just came home from Africa. I've got another one leaving in 2 weeks to go to Tahiti, and you're growing up really fast, right? I mean, that's a real, real responsibility. But then just the formal organization and the idea of home teaching or ministering, the concept of meeting together every Sunday with people who are different than you, being vulnerable, sharing your innermost secrets in front of a congregation one Sunday a month, you know, your feelings about something that's important to you, the ability for men to cry in front of a congregation and not be mocked, right? All of those things, if you were to design something, as Senator Sasse put in there, that would help prevent the tribalism, that would help prevent this moral decay and the you know, why we hate each other, you would put something like that in place. Something that, where if somebody house floods, people show up to help them. They know they have a safety net there. And that was really interesting. I'd never looked at it in that light until reading his book.
Yeah. And I think that's helpful. And I think it's easy to sort of pat ourselves on the back, like, look, we have the structure, like it's working, but a lot of times it doesn't work. I mean, we sort of go through the motions. We show up to church, but we don't want to be the guy that's crying. I mean, other people do that, or the structure's there. So any ideas on how we can sort of leverage that structure we have? It's almost like we have the vehicle, but nobody started the engine of it. Any thoughts on, and maybe that I'm interested on your approach that you're doing through political efforts, or maybe some plans you'd have, or what could just a local Elders Quorum president or a bishop do to sort of rev that engine of that structure that we have in place?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think that, well, first of all, I would say read the book. I mean, that would be one of my recommendations. Awesome. I think it's something everyone should read, because it's changed my outlook on church service, which I never expected. I mean, I thought it was a political book, and it certainly has influenced me there as well. So I guess if I were to break it into the two areas, on the political side, and everything I do, it's changed me. We're visiting all 248 cities. We're doing service projects in many of them. And people think, oh, that's kind of gimmicky, as you know.
Photo op, right?
Yeah, photo op. And it couldn't be further from the truth. It's not gimmicky at all. I believe in services policy. I believe that if we refocus our efforts as government from, again, trying to solve everybody's problems by just more money and spending, because government's not very good at that. And I don't mean that as a partisan Republican. Sometimes it comes off that way. I mean that in very practical terms. When I say government wasn't designed to solve all of our problems, you know, our legislature meets 45 days out of the year, the end of January through the middle of March. That's it. Like, you wouldn't run a business 45 days out of the year, you know, to solve problems. Our government was designed to prevent government from doing most things, because we'd had this really bad experience with our government before with England, and we didn't want anybody to become too powerful. And so we made it hard to change. We made it hard. We have checks and balances, and it's just hard to get anything done. That's a good thing. So what can government do? Well, government can convene. It can bring people together, and it can bring churches. It can bring nonprofits. It can bring the private sector together and say, we have a problem with homelessness. Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and, Gail Miller and Shelter the Homeless, whatever these, and we're going to work on this together, and we need your help because we can't do it. And that's a role for government.
Rather than just legislating something and say, exactly, this is the law now.
Yeah, right? we could pass a whole bunch more taxes and then try to figure out how to do it. And it wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. And so what we're hoping to do with these service projects is to inspire people and remind them that problems are solved at the community level by service, neighbors, churches, people coming together to help each other out. That's still the best way to do it. There's no substitute for that. And his book says that. On the church side, though, and this is what's important. I mean, I look at the tools we have today, and the changes that have been made, having 2 hours instead of 3 hours, which is just phenomenal. I love it. But the change in ministering, and I think if we really catch the vision, it's not just important for our personal salvation or for, you know, checking off some boxes to serve out of, you know, duty, but it's critical for the future of our nation and our world, that suicide rates, opioid addiction rates are skyrocketing. And why? These deaths of despair are because people don't have connection. Somebody much wiser than I once said that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And this is a way that we believe God has given us to connect with people and connect with our neighbors, connect with people who are different than us. And there is a real power than that. I always get a little upset when I hear people talk about, oh, Utah Mormons versus I lived in Virginia.
In the mission field, right?
But I also kind of get it, because, you know, we didn't have any family back in Virginia, and we felt far more connected with the members there than we do right now. Mm-hmm. And it's because we had to rely on each other, and we felt this kinship and this closeness. But I think properly understood and properly executed, that's exactly what we're talking about, this reliance on one another. And we have these, not arbitrary, but for the sake of us, we've been given these rules and these programs and these callings to help us learn how to do that. In a perfect world, I don't think there are any callings. I think we all just kind of take care of each other, and we'll get there eventually, but we're not there yet. And so when we do get these assignments, these opportunities, lean in and go for it. I know you probably ready for the next question, but one last thing is, my wife and I had this discussion many years ago about obedience and what that means. And we were going through this time where, and I think she'd be okay with me sharing this, that she was feeling exhausted by doing everything right. And after talking about it and figuring it out, we realized that there are different levels of reasons to obey. The most base is probably fear. Like, you know, I don't want to go to hell. I've read the scriptures about how ugly that is. Yeah. I don't want my sins shouted from the rooftops, whatever. So I'm going to obey just out of fear. There's kind of the next level, I believe, and this is kind of where we were finding ourselves, was obedience out of duty. And it's our duty. We should all obey out of duty. And so I'm doing my calling, doing it out of sense of duty. And what we realize is obedience out of a sense of duty is exhausting. It's not sustainable. You can do it for a while, but when you're obeying out of duty, you start to get really upset with everybody else because they're not. And you're like, come on, it's your duty. Why am I doing this and you're not? And then the highest is, of course, obedience out of love. And when you obey out of love, it changes everything. You're able to overlook all the flaws, all the mistakes, all the problems, all the issues that are out there. And you just do your very best because you love people and you love God and you care. And that's the prime directive. I believe if we do that, not just in the church, but if we do that as Utahns, as public servants, as leaders, I don't want to be governor bad enough to do it out of duty. I don't want to be governor bad enough to do it. It's a lot. But if I do it for the right reasons, like I can do service, I can visit 248 cities because I love people, not to campaign, not to just give a talking point speech, but because I care, I can do that. And it's energizing. It gives you motivation. So I think that's where we're missing, when we're missing in the church, and not everywhere, but certainly in some places, if we loved more and did it out of a sense of love, everything else would work out.
Yeah, I love that. And really, one thing I'm picking up from this discussion is a lot of times it's easy to say, okay, we're going to come together as a ward and we're going to do this service project. And maybe this is more of a Utah Latter-day Saint issue, but we sort of forget that our neighbors who aren't in the ward are being left out. And so what I'm learning from what you're saying is, if we can bring a community together, and if a lieutenant governor can do that by representing the state and saying, what other entities can we bring to the table? But for a ward to sort of take that, or a stake to be like, okay, we're stake, but what can we, who else, you know, the city council, what do they know that we don't, that we can work together, and what service project do they have in mind, or these things, like being more, less of a, you know, have these barriers from, or just these blinders on of just the ward. We're just going to do stuff for the ward, but to look at more of, we're going to do something for the community, right?
Yeah, Kurt, no, you've hit on something that I struggled with a lot. And I'm so glad you brought it up, because so what was interesting in our little town of Fairview, we have four wards basically. And when the pioneers came there, they built this building that it was called a dance hall. It was one of the first buildings they built, and it had been changed a little bit and added to. And it was where all the town activities happened. It was the gathering place. And over time, it had been worn down and the church stopped maintaining it. And then they sold it to the city for a dollar and it was falling apart. And we made a huge mistake when the church started taking over activities basically for the community. And in the town of Fairview, there became no meeting place. And if you move from one ward to another, you might as well have moved to a different state, right? You're kind of out of it. And those are people who belong to the same faith. I mean, for people who weren't members of that faith, as you mentioned, there's just this feeling like they didn't belong in the city. So we, as the mayor, we sat down and said, look, this matters. And so we put together this huge project. We restored the dance hall and had a place to come back and meet, and started trying to refocus it on community events. Now, churches can do that as well. And I believe our wards can absolutely do that and start thinking much more broadly about what is the activity and how can we invite the community. Payson has this incredible activity that we just went to this week. They bring in fish from Alaska, they call it a salmon supper. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have not.
I don't know how everyone in the state does it. I was really dubious.
I drive down there.
Well, I've heard about it for years and I'm like, why would I go to Payson to eat salmon in a park, right? I mean, so turns out it's like the biggest deal. They bring in 5,000 pounds of salmon, all right? fresh from Alaska. Wow. They the way they cook it is just incredible. 5,000 people come. They bring buses down from like Idaho and from Logan of seniors come down. The salmon, you get a pound of salmon on your plate. You know, it's like $18 or something. I don't know. It's incredible. The best deal you ever get. That started as a church activity. It was a ward fundraiser back 50 plus years ago, back in the 60s, like 59 years ago. And then it went to a stake level. And then they started partnering with the community and it ended up being a community event. But the church still helps and volunteers and participates. And those are the types of things that make me excited because it brings everyone together. You know, nobody knows who belongs to what faith or no faith, but it's lifting the community. It's a great fundraiser. They're able to do things for their parks and other things down there. And we've got to be thinking more broadly. We've got to be more community oriented and less kind of insular in our ward boundaries.
Yeah. And I love that the whole concept of how can we create this tradition or this activity in our ward or stake to outgrow our ward and stake and move into our community. I mean, that's powerful. Awesome. So a few more questions as we wrap up here. And one just like, I love leadership. I've, you know, served as a bishop in a stake presidency and I love those dynamics. I love the challenges. I have zero desire to go into politics. So give us a brief, what's your argument why somebody who appreciates leadership, has a desire for leadership, why should they even consider going into politics?
It's a great question. It's one I ask myself all the time, like, why am I doing this? And the easiest way to describe it is this. When the governor asked me to be lieutenant governor, and I've shared this before, but it was a really hard decision for us because we never planned. That's full time. That means giving up my job. It means a huge cut in pay. It meant we weren't moving. So it meant commuting 200 miles round trip every day. It meant time away from my family. I mean, it was awful. And I decided to say no. This was the opportunity of a lifetime. I mean, there was an article written in the Deseret News, a couple political talking heads, they had handicapped the 30 people most likely to be chosen as the lieutenant governor. I was not on that list, right? So I'd won the lottery. And here I was, I watched my little girl get off the bus. She was 6 at the time, big oversized backpack, walking up the lane to our house. And I just lost it. I'm just crying there. And I go into my wife and I said, I think we have to tell the governor no. And she in her wisdom, she looked at me and she said, okay. She said, we can tell him no, but we need to have a discussion about something first. She said, the problem with these jobs is we have too many people that really, really, really want these jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's the ego side of it. And for whatever power, I don't know.
Influence.
I don't get it. Influence. Yeah whatever. And she said, the problem with our country today is that there's so many good people who don't want to do it. And I don't blame them. It's awful a lot of the time. And so what I would say is, like, we believe that this stuff matters, that our country, our state, our local governments matter. We believe that God cares about this stuff. And that when we're in the service of our fellow men, we're in the service of our God. I believe that that applies 100% as much to public service as it does to church service. And I've seen it. I've seen those blessings in our lives. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we're the best at it or people in our church are the best at it. I mean, some of the best leaders I know in our state are not members of our church. I mean, there are just incredible people out there. But we of all people should have a desire to serve and give back. We should be the happiest people on earth. We should be the most optimistic people on earth, and we should be the most willing to serve. And so I know it's not for everyone, but I do know it's for many more people than are doing it right now. We often, especially in small towns, have city council seats that go vacant that we have to appoint someone to because not enough people will even run for office. And so I would say, you know, find your own answer, but be willing when you get that inspiration to do it. I know that church leadership is very much in favor of more people getting involved. They're making that easier and you know, asking people to go out and they don't care what party, but to go out and run for office, to run to be a delegate. They, you know, they're very encouraging of us participating in the political process. And our country needs that more now than ever.
Yeah. And really just like making that shift of being like a political role to a calling a lot of the time where, and I, what I love and some people may hate about our leadership in our church is that typically the guy who's is the next bishop doesn't want to be the next bishop. Yeah. You know, there's this nomination process through inspiration and so forth that happens. And hopefully more of that can happen in the political side, that like your experience that you didn't necessarily want this job, but you know, people were encouraging you, one being the governor, that no, we want you here and this is where we'd like to nominate you, and because you can have a difference rather than just the ego side of it.
Well, and it's a great, I mean, George Washington is a perfect example. Yeah. You know, another one you should read is the Chernow biography. It's probably even longer than the Lincoln one, but on George Washington, and he, you know, he wanted nothing more than to go back to his farm, but he felt this sense of duty, this sense of obligation, this love for his country. And so he did it. And I'm just glad we can have this conversation, because I hope more and more people will consider it, because it's the only way it's going to get better and the only way it's going to change is if people who aren't desperate for it actually decide to go for it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of church leaders that are phenomenal church leaders, and they would make phenomenal politicians.
Take the spiritual out of it, take the religious piece out of it. I mean, talk about incredible training. Overseeing a congregation, working through very, very difficult issues, understanding how to delegate. I mean, just if nothing else, I will tell you that overseeing, I think we had 33 funerals in my ward while I was there. Just dealing with families in those very difficult times, and you know, putting together a program and helping them through that's real leadership. Like I've called on those lessons learned many times. I had to go down to Southern Utah when two families were washed away in just a tragic storm, and you know, I think 13 people died in that flash flood, and the governor was in China, and I had to go down, and you know, what do you say to people at this time? Well, I had a lot of practice, and I was grateful for that practice to be able to go and empathize and have a very important conversation with people who were grieving.
Awesome. So if people want to follow you and maybe see where the RV's headed, I know you're a good follow on Twitter. That's a good place to start. But where else should people follow your journey?
It hasn't gotten me fired yet, my Twitter account, although I'm sure it's been close a few times. But you can follow me on most social media platforms at Spencer J. Cox or at Cox for Governor. And you can certainly find us online at votecox.com. And we, as we get close to going to another area, we'll post the schedule for when we're out there and visiting. And again, whether you vote for me, whether you vote for somebody else, vote, just get involved. I think we're better when people are participating in the process. Some people will like me, some people won't. I'm okay with that. And I just hope you find somebody you can like and somebody you can support. And I hope it's maybe one of your listeners that will be on the ballot next time.
Yeah, cool. And I got to mention that I mentioned my grandfather, who's 94 years old, that I was going to interview, and he's a lifelong Democrat. I was like, I'm going to interview the lieutenant governor. He says, I like him. I hope he wins. So, hey, you're a bipartisan efforts.
Tell him thank you. That's very nice of him.
Good.
And tell him not to tell anybody, because then I probably won't get elected. No, I'm just kidding. That's the tribalism problem in our country.
Exactly. So, last question I have, it's a lieutenant governor question, and I guarantee it's a question you never received. How has your time leading as lieutenant governor made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
Wow. You're right. That is the first time I've ever been asked that question. So for me, I've been able to see things and meet people. Let me put it this way. As lieutenant governor, I get to see people on their best days and their worst days. So I'm either, you know, handing out an award or cutting a ribbon or spending time at a conference where hopefully it's one of their best days. And I get to see people doing incredible things, like things no one knows about. I get to see it. I get to see it happening. And then I get to see people on their worst days where something really bad has happened. And what I found through all of that is that the worst of times brings out the best of people. And having been so close to godliness, so close to people who are thinking less about themselves and more about their neighbors, more about whoever it is, has made me want to be more like them, and them are more like our Savior Jesus Christ. And that's, it's people are good and people are great, and it makes me want to be better.
That concludes my interview with the Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. Bless his heart. Appreciate him for allowing me to sit down with him and fire some unique questions at him. Awesome guy, regardless of who you're, if you are in Utah, regardless of who you are going to vote for, Spencer Cox is a great guy. And whether he wins or doesn't win, he'd be an awesome neighbor and he'll always be an awesome member of the church. Now, if you want to meet the Lieutenant Governor, Spencer Cox, he is actually going to be introducing his boss, the governor, Gary Herbert, at the Moral and Ethical Leadership Conference that's put on by the BYU Management Society. Now, this is a conference I've attended the last 2 years, and it is phenomenal. It's held in Salt Lake City. I think they're doing it at the Conference Center Theater this year. Top-notch, awesome leadership conference. If you have a chance to be in the Salt Lake area on September 13th, this is a must-attend conference, and I would love to see you there. I'm definitely going to be there, and they have some phenomenal speakers. I will link to, in the show notes, to where to register and to see the awesome lineup of speakers that they will have, but it is a must-attend if you're in the Salt Lake area on September 13th. Plus, if you are a listener to Leading Saints, you get a discount, so go check it out. And don't forget, text the word LEAD to 474747 to get a free copy of How to Lead When You're Not the Leader.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.